From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. We'll spend some time with nature today. That's always nice, isn't it? In a moment, we'll learn about some of the state's bird species and the sounds they make. Plus, we'll visit North Georgia, where a museum is dedicated to the biggest urban legend of the forest.
Now, before you dismiss this sighting as another Bigfoot hoax, take a look at this footage shot by one of the hikers with his mobile phone.
There! See that? Bigfoot!
So was it a hoax?
No!
Or was it Bigfoot?
Yes! Discussion over.
Are you a Bigfoot believer? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can tweet us at OST Talk. We're also on Facebook, and we might feature your comment on the show. The Altamaha River is not one of Georgia's more popular natural landmarks. It's not a destination like Stone Mountain or Lake Lanier. But this little-known water source plays a vital role for several species of shorebirds during their migrations. One is the red knot. These tiny birds travel more than 19,000 miles during migration, and they use Georgia's coast as a safe haven. Author Deborah Kramer chronicled the red knot's journey in her latest book. It's called The Narrow Edge. I spoke with her last month and asked her about the name of her book.
I'm referring to the liminal porous place at the edge of the sea where the tide comes in and out. It's neither land nor water, or I guess you'd say it's both, and it's constantly changing.
And it also feels, certainly by the time you get to the end of the book, that the narrow edge is also our almost a window of opportunity that we have at this moment to either act on climate change or not. Did you sense that narrow edge as you were writing?
Well, yes, it is. It's an incredible opportunity for us, actually, because the water is rising and there is lots of wildlife living along the edge of the sea, but so are we. And in protecting their homes, we'll also be protecting ourselves.
Well, let's go to this tiny bird. The subtitle of your book is A Tiny Bird, An Ancient Crab, and an Epic Journey. And the tiny bird that you're talking about is the red knot. Let's first hear from the red knot. Here's the sound of one. What makes this bird special?
Well, to me, this bird is really special because it weighs no more than a coffee mug, and yet something that small manages to fly 19,000 miles every year from the very bottom of South America all the way up to the Arctic Circle and back.
And again, you said the very bottom of South America. I want people to picture that in their minds because this journey is unbelievable when you look at it on the map. They start, many of them start in Tierra del Fuego, right? The very southern tip of South America, and travel up through Canada to the Arctic where they breed. Is that right?
That's right. And the place on Tierra del Fuego is a really remote beach. It's just mile after mile of unbroken sand along the Strait of Magellan. And the tides are treacherous there and the winds are treacherous there. They're often blowing at hurricane strength. And the birds are there for 4 or 5 months.
But the reason that I'm talking to you, and I assume the reason that you'll be speaking at the Atlanta Audubon Bird Festival, is because of the very important stop that they make in Georgia at the Altamaha River. And that's where they encounter the horseshoe crab, which is the ancient crab of your title. Why is the horseshoe crab so important?
The horseshoe crab is so important to the red knot because its tiny pin-sized eggs constitute the fuel that'll take this bird all the way up to the Arctic. So a red knot needs to eat about 400,000 of those horseshoe crab eggs in order to gain enough weight to make the flight all the way up to the tundra and then have a few resources left over in case the snow hasn't started to melt and there's nothing to eat.
Is Georgia a kind of halfway point?
Georgia is a really important stop on this. I would say it's probably a little more than halfway, but for many of these birds, it's the last stop before they go up to the Arctic. So it's really important that they get enough food in Georgia. It's also true that the Altamaha River is a very important stop for them coming south as well.
So then what happens, and I'm not the expert, you are, so please correct me.
Not necessarily.
But I understand that part of the reason climate change is affecting these birds so much, and there's a Tufts University study that showed that almost 90% of North American shorebirds are at increased risk now. But one of the things is that when these eggs that you're talking about, they can hatch too early because of the warm temperature. Is that part of what affects the red knot?
One of the things that the Fish and Wildlife Service is concerned about is that as the water warms, the horseshoe crabs might come into spawn earlier, and the eggs might be there, and the birds might not have arrived. So they are concerned that that is a problem. What is interesting to me about that, though, is that these birds have an uncanny ability to find food within hours of its becoming available. So horseshoe crabs have just started spawning in big numbers in Georgia, and the birds will just miraculously appear on the beach where they've been spawning. So the last time I was on Little St. Simons, for example, there hadn't been any red knots seen yet. There hadn't been any horseshoe crabs. And then at night, the horseshoe crabs came in. And then the next morning, I went down to this inlet that I'd been going to every morning, and there were 1,000 red knots there eating the horseshoe crabs.
So I read another naturalist and author, Joel Greenberg, said perhaps the red knot should replace the canary in the mine as the harbinger of impending changes that are good neither for birds or people. I wonder what you make of that, this idea that the red knot could be our canary in the mine.
Well, he did say that about the narrow edge, and I think I would tend to agree with him, because the story of the red knot is really the story of 50 million other shorebirds coming through North America, many of which aren't quite as well known, maybe, as the red knot, although I'm discovering a lot of people don't know about the red knot either. But
or know when they're looking at one.
Right. Well, it's hard to recognize. It was even hard for me to recognize when I first started. But then once you get to see it, it's a beautiful, beautiful bird. And so I would agree with him. There are lots of other shorebirds that eat horseshoe crab eggs. There are lots of other shorebirds that live at the edge of the sea where the water is rising. And there are lots of other shorebirds that are nesting up in the Arctic, a place which is changing rapidly.
Do you have any idea how many miles you actually traversed while you were following this bird for this book?
Well, that was another thing. The birds go from this round trip from the bottom of South America up to the Arctic and back, and that's about 19,000 miles. And I went from the bottom of South America up to the Arctic and then back to my home in Massachusetts. And in order for me to do that, I logged in 44,000 miles. And then if you counted the translators who came with me, it was 66,000 miles just to follow this tiny bird.
Deborah Kramer is the author of The Narrow Edge. Georgia is home to almost 350 species of birds. We just heard about the red knot. Now let's learn about some of the other bird populations in the state. Our producer Sean Power spent a recent weekend with some local bird watchers to learn about the variety of chirps, tweets, and calls that can be heard here.
My name is Vinod Babu. I'm a postdoctoral researcher in Georgia Tech, and I'm one of the co-leaders of this walk today.
Hi, I'm Ralph Smith. I'm with the Atlanta Audubon Society, and I wanted to, you know, welcome along with Vinod, welcome you here this morning.
We have some robins on the lawn. We are actually hearing an eastern towhee sing now.
A lot of bird songs have, we make mnemonic sayings for them to help us remember their songs, and the one for the towhee is drink your tea, and it's drink your tea.
I'm with GPB, Georgia Public Broadcasting, the NPR affiliate. So question, did you know birds can sing?
No, I didn't know at all.
Really?
Yeah.
Does it sound like singing to you?
Yes, it really does. And it sounds beautiful, of course, because it's nature. My name is Ariana Tyson. I go to Georgia Cyber Academy, and I do dual enrollment at Gwinnett Technical College. Bird singing is their way of being themselves, because each type of bird has their own specific sound. And me, a lot of the times there aren't females that are into, you know, technology and the things that I'm into, and that's the way that I express myself. You know, I express myself with, you know, the coding that I do. And these birds, they express themselves with the way that they sing and the way that they fly.
Okay, so how many different birds are singing right now that we can hear? It feels like we're all over, all around them.
I think I'm hearing five or so. That's the towhee, cardinal. I heard a song sparrow there. The brown-headed cowbird is singing, and the house finch.
Wow.
My name is Sanji Henderson, internal auditor at Norfolk Southern.
Well, what do you think so far of what you've seen?
It's beautiful. It's hard for me to distinguish which birds are saying.
I know. I don't know how they're able to do it. I'm tone deaf, but I don't know how they're able to tell like which song is which. I don't get it. It all sounds the same to me.
It doesn't sound the same, but it's hard to pinpoint.
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah. Where are we right now?
We're in the forest, in Fernbank Forest.
Okay.
And we can see some of the restoration work that's being done back there.
Where are we going to see the thrasher?
We might see one, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Cool. It was like 2,000 songs, I think.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's the brown thrasher, which hopefully we'll see. It's one of the most prolific singers. It's got the widest repertoire of any bird in North America, and it's Georgia State bird.
Yeah. Well, I hope it can copyright some of those songs.
Well, no, it's actually mimicking other birds' songs, so if anything, the other birds should copyright it.
Or sue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sean Powers produced that segment on bird songs for us back in March. But consider this, is it accurate to describe sounds from animals as songs? We put that question to musicologist Jonathan Kramer. He teaches a class on bird songs at North Carolina State University.
Is music something that's species-specific to humans, or is music something that arises from nature? Is music based on the sound itself, or is music based on the intention of the sound producer or the intention of the listener? And that's sort of what this question hinges on. When birds are singing, are they doing the same thing that humans do when humans sing?
Now, I mean, Stravinsky had a lot of opinions on this. This has kind of been hotly debated in the music community, and he said that the sounds of nature are like music, but not music.
Correct. He's famous for making that differentiation, because for Stravinsky, music is something that humans do, and when a human makes music and communicates that musical intention to another human, that's what we mean by the word music, or at least that's what he means. When Oscar Hammerstein Jr. says, all the sounds of the world are like music, they're like music. We can listen to them as if they were music. We can enjoy them as if they were music, but they're not music. On the other hand, the sounds of the world, including bird song and I suppose frog song, although I can't think of an example, can become music in certain situations by any definition, like when the Finnish composer Ratavaro took a tape recorder up to Spitsbergen and recorded Migrating Swans, and then came back and wrote to his studio and wrote a concerto for birds and orchestra. Clearly the birds are music.
Let's take a listen, actually, Jonathan, to a little bit of that. This is from the Finnish composer Eino Juhani Rotavara. Jonathan, that's not necessarily completely unique. We have Vaughan Williams wrote The Lark Ascending. You've got Respighi and the Birds. You've got Elgar, who wrote The Owls and tried to include owl calls as well. Does bird song then become song, real live musical song, when it's used by a classical composer?
Well, yes. Again, depending on how you define music. If music has to do with how we hear these sounds, and the intention of the human to use the sounds of birds as a musical instrument, in a sense, as in the example we just heard, then surely I think that's music. There are other examples around the world, like Afghani musicians who bring birds in cages to their concerts, and they start to play their rababs, and the birds join in and sing with the rabab, and that's part of the performance. And that's clearly another example. In the case of Respighi, at the end of the Pines of Rome, the third movement, there's a little record that goes with the score, and when a symphony orchestra is going to play it, they get the record with the parts, the cello parts, the violin parts, and at the end of the third movement, you put the drop the needle. That was the technology in those days.
Yeah, I think it's on MP3 now.
And then you get the birds. And when I used to play with the North Carolina Symphony, we had a bass player named John Cubbage, I remember. And when we did the Pines of Rome, he could whistle it, so we didn't have to get the record. It was a big moment every year when the Pines of Rome were played. He got to do the whistling.
We've got about 30 seconds left, Jonathan Kramer.
Yeah.
Do you have a bird song that you particularly like?
I particularly like the little bird and played by the piccolo in Prokofiev's Peter and the Wolf.
What?
Et cetera, et cetera.
Whoa, that is not easy to whistle.
No, it isn't.
Jonathan Kramer is a professor of music at North Carolina State University. Jonathan, thanks so much.
It was a pleasure talking to you.
This is On Second Thought. Most people reach for the cough syrup or ibuprofen when they're sick. But in the Gullah community, many people reach for an herb called Life Everlasting instead. It's boiled into a tea by the Gullah Geechee people on Georgia's coast, and it helps treat congestion and coughs. Folk remedies like this are used less and less today. But one store in Hilton Head hopes to keep the Gullah Geechee medicinal tradition alive. Lynn Rivera is the owner of Back to Nature. I spoke with her earlier this year about her mission as an entrepreneur and preservationist. Tiara Banks also joined us. She wrote her master's thesis about Gullah Geechee medicine. I began by asking Lynn about which herb flies off the shelves at her store.
I would say that peppermint is probably the leading herb that we sell.
And sold in like a leaf form or a peppermint oil, or how do people buy it?
They mostly buy it in the form of an essential oil, because it can easily be applied to the area of concern, for example, a headache, stomach ache, or any kind of arthritic pain in a certain area. They could simply apply the oil directly to the area.
And supposedly I've read that the smell of mint actually counters fatigue and can improve your brain function, which is kind of fascinating. But Tiara, one of the reasons that you focused on folk medicine among the Gullah community is because it's beginning to disappear. Is that right?
That's correct.
How quickly could we see some of these traditions go?
Pretty quickly. I know during my research, out of the 20 participants, most of them were well into over the age of 60. So that lets you know that the younger generation is somewhat shying away from it. It's not being passed down amongst generations as it was years ago or generations ago.
Lynn, do you see that as well, that it's older people that come in to get folk remedies?
Not really. What I see is that the herbs are probably being practiced and used less in the Gullah culture, but there are different cultures that are increasingly coming into the store and buying different essential oils and medicinal herbs.
I wonder, Tiara, if one of the things that you notice is that people are both going to a traditional doctor, right, and then also using folk remedies. Is that one way to keep it from disappearing, is by helping it to merge a little more comfortably with modern medicine?
Yes, most of my participants that I did interview did utilize a dual healthcare system. Most of them were not discussing this use of traditional medicine with the doctor. So that's where a lot of my research come in. It's almost somewhat like it was a hidden secret amongst the population.
Maybe because they didn't want to get scolded.
Right. Didn't want to get scolded and didn't want to, you know, be told to shy away from it. They trust it somewhat more than the westernized medicine, because it's been passed down amongst generations, their grandmothers, you know, grandfathers. It's been passed down, so it's a trusted way of treating illnesses.
You probably work with a lot of people who, if you tell them that you use those things growing up, they probably think that's fun. I'm sure they don't take it seriously.
Probably not. Probably not.
Do you talk about these things with your fellow?
I talk about them amongst my employees, not so much with the doctors and the nurses.
Why not?
They might shy away from it or do think that it's, you know, they would probably advise to use something else.
Lynn, do you find that Tierra was saying that many of the people that she spoke to would go to the regular doctor but wouldn't tell them they were also using folk remedies. Have you found that to be the case?
Well, sometimes, yes. Sometimes people will tell me that they don't let their doctor know that they're using natural remedies. But I always advise people that if you don't really know what your condition is or the problem is, that you should definitely see a physician, a licensed physician, and get some screening, testing, or whatever is necessary.
So you will actually advise people to go to the doctor. Is there resistance to that?
No, because lots of people are looking for a quick fix. Say, for example, someone will walk in the door and say, what do you have for diabetes? So I would let them know, we don't just have something for diabetes that's going to cure your diabetes. Actually, you would have to focus on more than just a magic herb. You would have to detox the body, change your diet. And, of course, if you don't know exactly what's going on with your body, you actually need to see a medical doctor and get an examination.
So, Tierra, I mean, are there any folk remedies you still use?
I have a daughter. I definitely use the copper penny. And I do herbs myself, you know, the sassafras, the life everlasting. You can get it because I have connections of getting it. So I still practice a lot of the herbs.
And you want to keep that tradition going with your daughter?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so Lynn, tell me another remedy perhaps that might work really well from your store as opposed to, say, me coming in and saying, cure my diabetes. What could I come in with that you would actually have a real cure for?
Well, here's something that I find to be very beneficial. Lots of people simply have pain as a result of inflammation, arthritis, tendonitis, carpal tunnel, whatever. I suggest that to them that they simply use turmeric root powder, and this is in a certified organic form. To actually take it, add water, make a paste, apply it to the area of concern, and wrap it. And we find over and over that it's very good for pulling inflammation from the area.
Tierra, one of the focuses of your thesis, though, was to try to change minds of the medical community. And you talked a lot about cultural competence. What does that mean?
Well, just the doctors being aware and opening up that dialogue and just understanding the particular community that they service. You need to know, especially dealing with the Gullah Geechee background, you need to know about their cultural beliefs. These questions need to be asked when they are servicing or helping these particular this particular population and around the world, because a lot of people of color everywhere are using or going back to using traditional medicine. And it just needs to be an open dialogue so that you know, like Ms. Lynn Rivera said, to know when it's time to go to the doctor if you know that the traditional remedy you've been using is not getting the condition together.
But part of the problem is a lack of trust.
A lack of trust, which dates back from slavery. So a lack of that mistrust and just the family and the culture, you know, it's been passed down. You trust your family more than you trust the outsider. So, just that trust of believing in what your family traditions that's been passed down.
Lynn Rivera is the owner of Back to Nature in Hilton Head, and Tierra Banks wrote her master's thesis on Gullah Geechee medicine. A new museum in North Georgia pays homage to a legend, a huge, hairy legend, Bigfoot. That sound was recorded by Ron Moorhead in the early 1970s. It's one of many sounds that visitors can hear at Expedition Bigfoot, the Sasquatch Museum. It's in Cherry Log, Georgia. I spoke with the owner, David Becerra, in March. We were also joined by Bigfoot enthusiast Keith Bearden of Dallas, Georgia. He's the author of Forest Friends of the Night, and he hosts campouts with other Bigfoot trackers. So I had to ask Keith if he's found real evidence of Bigfoot's existence.
Yes, and we've already found evidence this past, yesterday. We found a very nice track yesterday.
Like a footprint?
Yes.
What does it look like?
Looks like a ordinary human foot, but it's a lot bigger.
But can you give me an idea of how much bigger?
The one that we found yesterday is from a younger one. It's approximately 5.5 inches wide, and it's about 11 and a half inches long. We've also found one there not too long ago, a couple months back, that was in excess of 17 inches.
17 inches. David, do you have like either molds or tracked photos at the museum?
We do. We have several. As a matter of fact, we have the largest permanent display of track casts anywhere. Many of them came from retired U.S. Forest Ranger Paul Freeman, who used to work for the Forest Service, and after he retired in the early 90s, he spent most of his off time out in the Blue Mountains of Washington casting many kinds of casts, not just foot casts, but hand casts, and some very unusual casts that you can see here in the museum.
What's kind of your shining jewel of the museum? What's the best artifact or photo that you have there?
Well, we have so many casts, artifacts, lots of photos of real Sasquatches. But probably my favorite exhibit is the Ape Canyon exhibit, because I think there's so much history behind the phenomenon of Sasquatch that people just aren't familiar with. Back in the early 1920s, a group of four miners were descended upon by a group of Sasquatches. It was written about extensively. We have a full life-size display of it here. And I think when people see not just words on a page, but when they see a full life-size display of what happened in that cabin, I think it strikes a very deep chord.
Keith, give me a description of what Sasquatch looks like, because I assume he doesn't look like the way you see on TV and movies, or does he?
No, a lot of the TVs and movies portray them to be more of the monster type. Actually, it's quite the opposite. I haven't seen one as close up as my wife did. So the ones that I have seen from a distance are very large. The one that I've seen last year was extremely large, 10.5 feet.
Well, you can't just drop that detail and not explain how close your wife got to a Bigfoot.
Okay, I will go into that. We were at our camp a few years back, and she had seen something. We were standing with our backs to I was standing with my back to the wood line, and she was standing there in front of our camper. And she's seen, by the time I turned around, he had peeked back around, but he had stuck his head out from around a tree, and he was only about 15 to 20 feet away. But basically, the way she described her visual was a big man. He had a lot of hair around the edges of and kind of a dome on top of his head, the typical that people report. But she said the face itself was a tannish brown, hair was darker, and he had a mustache and like a small beard, but most of his face was clean, other than that there was not hair all over his face. But she said very a prominent brow ridge across the top, but she said very human-like. That's what struck her, and his eyes were very human-like.
David, the recording that we heard earlier was that was of a Bigfoot?
Yeah, a group of Bigfoots that Ron Moorhead and some hunter friends had accidentally discovered at the remote hunting camp in the High Sierras. And they spent the 1971, 72, and part of 73 recording them with the help of Al Berry, who was a reporter for one of the local papers up there. So there's many hours of that kind of recording, all different kinds of reaction, emotion. And Scott Nelson, a retired cryptolinguist, has deciphered the phonetics of it. he doesn't know what they're saying, but he has broken it down so you can actually see the phonetics of it. But again, we don't know what they're saying.
If you're just joining us, you just heard David Becerra. He's the founder of Expedition Bigfoot, the Sasquatch Museum. It just opened in Cherry Log, Georgia. And also on the line is Keith Bearden. He's a Sasquatch enthusiast in Dallas, Georgia, and author of the book Forest Friends of the Night. And I assume that since you've called it Forest Friends, Keith, you don't consider this Bigfoot or Sasquatch to be dangerous.
Well, I can't say they're not dangerous. The interaction that I have had, per se, has not been. The thing that I would tell anyone is you have to go into the woods with respect for every living thing. And the Bigfoot especially, you have to respect them. You have to respect who they are. But, you know, it's just like if anyone were to come into your home, you go in with respect. You don't go barging in with guns or, you know, threatening anyone. I'm sure that they could be rather dangerous if that was the case.
I looked online and there are other Bigfoot museums. David, do you have a goal for a number of visitors?
We have been so busy. The wife and I have been really surprised at how busy, because it's not even what they call season up here in North Georgia. But there's so many people that have actually seen them up here that they finally have a place to come and tell their story.
Yeah.
And we have been absolutely just so surprised at how many folks locally right here at Cherry Log, Blue Ridge, LJ, Gilmer County, that's just here, have seen them.
Well, if our listeners want to visit, that museum is called Expedition Bigfoot, the Sasquatch Museum. You can find pictures from the museum at facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. It's in Cherry Log, Georgia. And David Becerra, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thanks to Keith Bearden. He's written about the legendary creature and holds Bigfoot campouts in Dallas, Georgia. Thanks, Keith.
Thank you.
That's our show for today, but we will have another great one for you tomorrow, I promise. And we can do that because of your support. Donations from listeners like you help us connect you with the most interesting stories of our state. You are just a phone call away or a click away from the chance to become a member, to become a part of this show as a supporter. It's really easy to do, and it only takes a minute.